Support for Cap Radio's Insight with Vicky Gonzalez is made possible by the generosity of donors like Dr. Will Green and Martine Palomar, who encourage you to join them in sustaining the future of fact-based nonprofit journalism in the region.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Lake Tahoe is a mile-high natural jewel. America's largest alpine lake is encircled by the Sierra, drawing three times the visitors as Yosemite National Park. But Tahoe has long shouldered its share of human-inflicted problems, dating back to the gold rush. And today, concerns range from the overall health of the basin to the harms of tourism and continuing to build despite the high risk of wildfires. A new investigation from CalMatters is diving into Lake Tahoe's constant tug and pull between development and preservation. I sat down with environment reporter Julie Cart and statistical journalist Natasha Uskategi-Liggett about their two-part series regarding the problems plaguing this unique treasure. And a note, CalMatters is a nonprofit newsroom that partners with public media stations across the state. Well, Julie and Natasha, thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, Julie, I want to start with you because you've long reported on the wide-ranging impacts of wildfires, also the environment in California. When did a deep dive into Lake Tahoe get on your radar?
I look at it from a number of different points of view. One is that it is managed, Lake Tahoe is managed in a way that's unique. In the United States, there are agencies that oversee it in almost every aspect. We don't do that with natural places, with lakes or mountains, or really even in this depth in places like parks or forest services. So that was interesting to me. And at CalMatters, we put a real premium on accountability of state agencies. And that made me think, how much money is being spent to make sure that Lake Tahoe remains as beautiful, clear, and blue as it's always been? Where is the money going, and is it working? And so it was really an accountability idea to start with.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, because it's constantly brought up that Lake Tahoe is the largest alpine lake and one of the deepest in the United States. It's known for its water clarity, this natural jewel that is unique in the United States. But unlike perhaps other popular natural resources like Yosemite or Crater Lake in southern Oregon, it's not a national park. And I think that kind of opens it up to these potentially competing interests that you really dive into in this series.
If you think about the elements that go into maintaining the lake, or looked at another way, if you look at the things that impair the quality, the water quality, and the general environment in the lake and around it, a lot of it comes down to people, us. 15 million visitors a year, three times Yosemite, which is staggering. On any busy summer day, there could be 200,000 people. So you think about what our human impact is, and you multiply it. So someone throws a piece of trash down, it in and of itself, it's not such a horrendous thing. We all do that from time to time, but it's magnified. And it's magnified in particular because this is a very special, distinct place that one guy said, if a drop of water gets in the lake, it's going to stay there forever. It's hard to get things out. It's hard to clean a lake. It's hard to protect it. And it's very, very expensive. So everything we do, the kind of competing interests of preservation, recreation, the economy, development, all very necessary because we visit it, but people actually live there. It's very hard to manage all that. Very, very difficult.
These issues, these competing interests, I mean, it's long been part of this debate about striking that right balance, right, between humans and this natural resource. How did that shape your approach to this story? Because you could have gone in a lot of directions. You could have had a 10-part series, but you honed it down into two.
Well, the second part was about fire and didn't involve financial information quite so much. But we wanted to see where the money was going and for what purpose. And what came out is what a lot of people have already written about and what folks who visit know is the original focus, which was very specifically on repairing, preserving the lake, has shifted, and it's a lot more, as Natasha's work discovered, more money, more emphasis on improving transportation, how we get around the lake, how we get to resorts, and development, which helps the tax base, good for the economy, but impacts the lake. And all of these things impact the lake. So it was very hard to parse all those things and to make them distinct because everything is so interconnected there. It was very hard to pull it apart.
Well, you focus heavily on the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. For people who don't know what this agency is, how big of a deal are they?
They're a very big deal. I rather glibly call them the concierge for the lake. But when the decision was made in 1969 by Congress to set up this authority to manage the lake based on what they saw was years and years of environmental degradation. They understood that the Congress said we need an overarching agency to look at this. They built this crazy thing, 2 states, 5 counties, a tribe, you know, all the cities that are involved are 1 city, South Lake Tahoe, and it's cumbersome and enormous and extremely powerful and influential, and it has changed over time. So it's quite unusual. It's an experiment.
How has their mission changed? They've been around for over 50 years now.
There would be debate about this from the agency. They're always focused on maintaining the environmental integrity of the lake. And if I say that they've emphasized transportation and dealing with transportation issues, they would say that directly would help the lake. And there's been trying to get a grip on development because there's only so much space. More than 80% of the land around the lake is operated and owned by the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service. So it's a matter of maintaining the caps on development that the agency already has, but trying to encourage development. So a lot of it's going up.
There's a lot of money that's going into maintaining the quality and the environment surrounding Lake Tahoe. But, you know, you paint out that there's still a lot of environmental degradation taking place. So why isn't this money and this investment going as far as it should? Are there other competing interests, perhaps like development? Like you may be focusing on the environment, but if you continue to build at a rapid rate, then it can kind of curb the intention of that investment and that funding.
Yeah, the shift that a lot of activists in the region see, which is toward a more friendly approach to development. It's an organic thing. Each county has its own particular interest. It has a piece of the lake, its little foothold, and it may decide that we want, on the Nevada side, we want gaming. That's, you know, that's where the dough is. We're going to get a lot of people here. They're going to come and play and go to stay in our hotels. California may not like that. So there are competing interests, development, anti-development, slow development, none at all. Housing is hugely important there. It's quite expensive. And the workforce, which is largely the service industry, but also teachers and nurses and things like that, they cannot afford to live in the basin. So they live up in Reno. They go up to Truckee and live elsewhere. Again, more miles, more traffic, more pollution. So I am so glad I'm not in charge of that. And so would everyone else be. But it's there's so many competing interests.
Natasha, you looked at all of this through a data lens. What excited you about this project and working on this?
I think it was definitely a very challenging data approach to this project that was exciting in many ways, but also extremely frustrating. There are over 200 different funders that invest in projects in the Tahoe Basin, and this is a myriad of funders from both states, funders from the 5 counties in the Tahoe Basin, local governments, federal, private organizations, all of this stuff, and they're all giving money to each other through grants or kind of what have you. So it's this very complex interwoven web that is hard to dissect for sure. So yeah, it was kind of fun and exciting to be able to piece all the different puzzle pieces together.
I mean, what you kind of laid out, it just, when I visualize it, it's like a ball of funding yarn and you need to unravel it.
Sorry, I would just say this kind of meticulous work that Natasha does is the scaffolding for this story. Without her, I would have written a story in broad terms that said, oh, these guys are spending way too much money here. There's been a shift of this, and boy, aren't we dumping money into Tahoe. And readers would have said, yeah, I heard that at the coffee shop last week. We were able to do, with Natasha's set of skills, is to just peel the onion and continue to do it over months. I mean, she talked and requested records from multiple agencies, federal, state, local, all kinds of things, found, in fact, went over their bookkeeping and found inaccuracies, double, I'll say, billing. I mean, she found mistakes, and that can happen, of course, when you're dealing with this complicated projects. So it's so important to have that kind of reporting because it shows the work. It's not just broad-based sniping. We showed a trend, a true trend, and it was only through the kind of work that Natasha does. I can't do that.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm chatting with Julie Cart and Natasha Uskoteki-Liggett about their investigative series into the challenges facing Lake Tahoe. As we wind down the conversation, I do want to get to the second part of your series because it does look into the challenges surrounding wildfire risk in Lake Tahoe. And we don't need to really go that far back into history. We can go back to 2021 and the Caldor fire as a warning cry, but there have been other wildfires over the years. I think of the Angora fire, for example. How has living with this risk changed over the years, Julie?
It's changed quite a lot, and in Tahoe as well as around the state. Much more understanding about preparing your home, having defensible space. What does that mean? What does it cost? Everyone knows where they live. They know the kind of fire risk they're in. The issue, at least in the second part of the series, has less to do with the risk, which is, you know, sort of speaks for itself. It's how do you get people out of harm's way? There will be fires there. There will be more fires there. What do you do when you have a lake that's encircled by a single roadway that's two lanes and there's a ton of people trying to get out and there are not a lot of ways out? And it's really, really difficult.
Yeah, that terrain and that infrastructure around Lake Tahoe is really challenging. And I remember talking with a fire department a few years ago in Tahoe, and they were explaining that, you know, on weekends, a population of 23,000 can balloon to a couple hundred thousand people on a popular holiday weekend. And that can strain cell service, that can strain emergency response. When you talk to emergency responders, what keeps them up at night?
You're right, Vicki. The thing that people rely on when there is a fire is information. So they need to know, what are my evacuation routes? When am I going to be notified? When should I evacuate? And a lot of that depends, as you say, on cell service and internet service. So those are some things that often aren't present during a fire. That's very difficult. So what keeps them up at night is, you can imagine the worst case scenarios, you know, the height of summer, a big unmanageable fire, which is to say most fires in California these days, in the wrong place. The evacuation is the big problem. And the person I think who kind of had the worst case scenario is Gary Guerin, who's the fire chief at Fallen Leaf Lake, which is a wonderful little community tucked in near Lake South Lake Tahoe. They have like a half a road in and out. And what often happens when a fire happens and there's evacuations, and people don't evacuate early enough or when they've first been ordered and people are trying to get on a road, and here comes all this fire equipment that's quite large for any sized highway or road, and you're at a standoff. There's no way to pull off. Those folks cannot evacuate unless they go really early. So that is like the worst case scenario because there's no way out.
Yeah, I rode my bike on that, you know, road. You know, I'm using quotation marks. And yeah, it is tricky, especially when you have vehicles. And that wasn't, of course, during an emergency. How long could it take to evacuate the Tahoe area, given that you're really funneling so many people into very limited infrastructure?
Well, there was an analysis done by a company using, or two companies, using AI and computer-generated scenarios. And they discovered, plugging in the worst case. So this is a criticism of this. They cherry picked, you know, every bad thing that could be in place and said that it could take as long as 14 hours to evacuate the basin. When you consider people are taking motorhomes and fifth wheels, and if one breaks down or you're trying to drive through smoke and you go off the side of the road, everything's at a standstill. So it's not like, oh, we'll just get on this road that everybody's moving slowly, but we're on our way out. All it takes is one accident, inattention, any kind of things. People tend to get out of their cars and think they can outrun fires, which is just the worst thing you could possibly do. So they used this information and plugged it in, and it was highly criticized by fire authorities because it was, you know, understandably, they did pick the worst case scenario. I think you have to know that when you're planning, obviously, because you have to plan for the worst. So there are other scenarios that are 4 hours, 11 hours. It's just a long time to be sitting in a car and relying on everybody to move and keep their head.
Mm. Natasha, where did your data come into play here?
A lot of it was looking at the risk that had been assessed both by CAL FIRE and by the U.S. Forest Service. And they found that a lot of the area around Lake Tahoe, and they specifically look at what they call state responsibility and local responsibility area. So this is like towns, it's the city of South Lake Tahoe. And they saw that pretty much all of this area was at very high, they ranked it as a very high fire hazard severity zone. And then the USFS, they also look at wildfire hazard potential, which essentially measures the potential for there being a wildfire that is difficult to manage. And they saw that a lot of the Tahoe Basin was at high risk for this kind of fire.
When it comes to both of these series, Natasha, what do you hope your findings translate into? It was a tremendous amount of work that you did.
I think what I'm hoping with these numbers is some level of accountability. I think being able to piece together the more granular trend and be able to literally point to a graph that shows water quality spending is going down and this recreation and transportation spending for the past several years has actually surpassed spending on water quality projects. I think that's really powerful, and being able to present it in a clear way that's understandable to readers that people in the Tahoe region can hopefully use and point to if this is not kind of what they're hoping to see. So yeah, essentially just increased accountability for really shining a light on how all of this funding that is coming into the Tahoe Basin is actually being used.
Yeah. Julie, as we wind this conversation down, I mean, you've probably danced around these issues for years as an environment reporter, but what surprised you most out of this two-part series?
Probably the evacuation stuff. The numbers are really frightening, and this isn't the only place in California that presents this kind of scenario. And that's just a feature of living in California. We know that something will burn. The fire officials always joke, if you happen to live in a parking lot, you're probably not going to face a fire. But most of us don't live in Costco parking lots, thank goodness. But there are zoning rules for a reason. We're well aware of earthquake seismic activities and the dangers, but we don't include fire as much. We let the market decide. There's very little institutional information or direction to people about building in these fire-prone areas. There's very few entities that are not allowing it. They're just saying, if you're going to do it, here's what you have to do, and letting people decide. And I don't know, people aren't that informed or sophisticated about fire, except that it's bad.
Finally, what do you hope readers do with all of this information that you and Natasha compiled?
I think the part of it that is most of it, Natasha's work, that is the accountability part of it, looking at the money. I think that's very healthy, and everyone should embrace that and welcome it, because it's they're public institutions and it's public money. On the other hand, I think it's really important for people who are visitors to wild places, which Tahoe still is, it's just to be more mindful. What is my impact? What am I doing? Just not to be a nanny state and not to not have fun and, you know, be able to do things you want to do, but understand that you are part of a horde of people who want to do the same thing, who want to get a good parking spot. So I'm just going to park right here on the edge of the road. It won't hurt anything. Just to be more mindful of maintaining the integrity of a place that you love so much, because a lot of people want to visit and a lot of people do, and we just can't keep trashing. It's not about trash, but all of our actions have an impact when you're dealing with these kinds of landscapes. And it's a mindfulness. And I don't mean that in a woo-woo way. It's just thinking about, oh, I'm doing this, but so are so many other people. Maybe I shouldn't do this thing.
Well, Julie and Natasha, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That is my conversation with environment reporter Julie Cart and statistical journalist Natasha Uskategi-Liggett surrounding their investigative series into the challenges facing Lake Tahoe. Tomorrow, we'll be joined by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. Still ahead, she's a regular voice on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Paula Poundstone joins us ahead of her event in Folsom. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.